Funding for Think comes from SMU Doctor and Master of Liberal Studies programs.
On a beautiful day in May of 1915, passengers aboard one of the world's most distinctive luxury liners were finishing up sumptuous lunches as the ship steamed toward port in Liverpool, with the coast of Ireland visible in the distance. Many were relieved that despite ominous warnings about German aggression, the voyage had been smooth and uneventful. Then came the seemingly impossible, a direct hit from a torpedo fired by a U-boat commander who had no qualms about civilian casualties. 20 minutes later, the Lusitania was underwater. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. We remember this infamous disaster from history lessons in school, but most of us didn't learn exactly how it tied in to the ways that new technology radically changed warfare in the early part of the 20th century, or that the Lusitania came tragically close to being out of harm's way when that deadly torpedo was launched. Author Eric Larson shares those stories in his suspenseful new book, Dead Wake, The Last Crossing of the Lusitania. The book is out now in paperback, and Eric Larson is in town to speak to Arts and Letters Live tonight at First United Methodist Church. Eric, welcome back to Think.
Thank you very much.
If there is one thing history should tell us, it is not to have any hubris when it comes to a ship. Nobody called this one unsinkable. People remembered Titanic, but many people assumed it was as safe as a ship could be. Why?
Yeah. Well, first of all, along those lines, it's noteworthy to note that on the day it departed New York, it was full. You know, it had full complement of passengers and crew. Nobody left, even though that very morning there was an announcement from the German embassy warning people who were, in fact, you know, planning on going to Britain that the war zone, as they called it, around Britain meant that you were doing so at your own risk. And it was that very morning that this was in the paper. And it didn't put anybody off, you know, because there was this belief that the ship was, you know, sort of like Banks, you know, too large to be sunk, too large and too fast. And there was a pervasive belief that the rules of civilian maritime warfare forbade any kind of attack on a civilian vessel. There was a belief that that still held. It was being eroded rapidly by Germany, but there was a belief that nobody would attack a civilian liner, especially not one so large.
It was fast in part because it had these four funnels and, you know, the furnaces to go along with it. What's interesting is that from a distance it must have looked so sleek and it had electricity all throughout, but down in the bowels of the ship were human beings 24/7 shoveling coal.
24/7 shoveling coal. I mean, it's like it just, it really is an incredible juxtaposition of you know, just as you say, sleek and glamorous, beautiful silk walls in the first class dining room, and then you get down there into the boiler rooms, and it's like being in a cave, you know, literally. I mean, there's coldest everywhere, mountains of coal, and guys just endlessly shoveling and wheeling coal from the mounds of coal and the bunkers along the side of the ship to the furnaces, and there's dust everywhere, and it's heat, and it's like. Really like hell, you know.
I didn't realize how much like hell it would be aboard a German U-boat, a proto-submarine. These were really dank, unpleasant spaces.
Dank, unpleasant spaces, that's a good way to put it. And when you fill that dank, unpleasant space with 36 men wearing leather suits and not changing for, you know, 14 days on end, it kind of gives you a – with one bathroom, not even a bathroom, a lavatory essentially, gives you a sense of how that was. And then and there were also, you know, at different intervals, the temperature within that submarine would fluctuate and would rise if it were – paradoxically, if it were underwater for a time, up to like 100 degrees inside this sort of festering, you know, hot hot chamber with the walls were just sort of dripping with condensation and so forth. Not my idea of a good time. And yet, for German sailors, the submarine service was considered one of the most prestigious things to join because they knew they would get action.
Subs could go really fast on the surface or fairly fast.
But fairly fast.
Very slow and cumbersome at depth.
Very slow and cumbersome at depth. Yeah, that was one of the things that kind of surprised me. They really submarines. One of the important things that I really had to get into my head, and I hope readers do as well, is how new and novel a submarine was at the time. And we take it for granted now. You know, all the movies, you know, Run Silent, Run Deep, and all that stuff. We all kind of know what a submarine is. At the time, submarines were brand new. The British Navy and the German Navy neither knew how to deal with a submarine. They really didn't know that they were going to be a terribly effective weapon. Of course, they became so, and they absolutely transformed the rules of maritime warfare because of their design. You know, I mean, the old rules were, in the case of a civilian ship, that if you attacked a civilian cargo ship, let's say, or a liner, you had to stop it, and you could search the manifest, and if you found contraband, you had to make sure, first of all, that all the passengers and the crew were safe, meaning you take them on your ship or you put them ashore. If it was necessary to sink the ship, fine at that point. But mostly, most ships under those circumstances would be taken into a port and it would be evaluated exactly what to do with the ship through what was called a prize port and a prize court in that port that would determine the fate of the ship. And so then suddenly along comes a submarine with barely enough room for 36 men. What do? You challenge a ship. You can't take anybody aboard. You can't spare the crew to bring it to shore. So suddenly the rules have changed. And one of the messages is also, you know, on the one side there's the warning of hubris. And the other side is when you have a new weapon, it is something like this. It is foolhardy to think that it won't be used to maximum effect. You know, it's foolhardy to think that society will agree that there are limits to how this thing will be used because it's not going to happen. And in the case of the submarine during World War I, that's what happened. You know, they use it to absolute maximum advantage, including ultimately sinking a very large passenger ship.
How was it that the British were not in full understanding of just how powerful submarines could be? They had them, but they didn't really maximize their capability to the same extent that the Germans did.
The British approached submarines in actually a more, you know, I don't want to make cultural comparisons, but they approached it in a more gentlemanly, more civilized way. From the beginning, it was not their attitude that submarines should be used to sink ships without warning. It was more for coastal defense. They were to be used primarily against German warships. Germany, from the outset, had sort of had adopted a very different outlook toward submarines and toward commercial shipping, because key part of its strategy was to try to starve Britain. And, you know, Britain was an island nation and relied entirely on incoming supplies and so forth. And so it made perfect sense. It was a very rational strategy. That's also a danger. You know, the rational can lead to some pretty macabre results.
So you have the Allies and the Central Powers warring it out in Europe. Meanwhile, the United States has managed to remain neutral, which is what a lot of people wanted. And the U.S. President Woodrow Wilson was supremely distracted, first by grief and then by a new romance.
He was distracted, although he was still doing his job. I want to specify that. His wife had died in August of 1914, contemporaneously with the start of World War I. If you can imagine what a traumatic event that the war was itself for Wilson, but also then he loses his wife. And it really, he was, you know, the White House was a very lonely place for him. He was really haunted by the loss of his wife. Until one day he spies this beautiful widow in Washington, D.C. and falls absolutely in love with her. And yes, he became very distracted. He would write these endless letters of longing and passion day after day after day to this woman. I'm talking about letters 12 pages long. In one case, the postscript to a letter was 10 pages long.
This is not the buttoned-up academic we think of.
This is not the buttoned-up academic we think of. And as I was reading these things in the Library of Congress, I was just so taken aback, but also a new respect for Wilson. I knew he was a great president, but he was always to me kind of a stiff. You know, I was not that interested in Wilson as a human being. But now suddenly I realize this man had dimension and he had nuance. And yes, he was distracted by this, but again, he was able to keep context. Another thing that really came to respect about Wilson is that he really wanted to keep America out of the war in a very sort of deep-seated, visceral way. He understood on a level that I think not many of his peers did at the time that America was not yet ready for the commitment to war. You know, that there were people who talked about war, but you know, engaging in it was something very, very different. And he managed to keep America out of the war for another 2 years after the Lusitania, which was another shock to me, another surprise to me, because in high school, you know, I'd absorbed the idea that the Lusitania was essentially the World War I equivalent of Pearl Harbor, mm-hmm. which it was not.
And in fact, it was not until the interception of the Zimmerman telegram.
So many other things had happened in between. There were other attacks on various ships. Then came the famous Zimmerman telegram, where in effect Germany was offering Mexico parts of Texas and New Mexico. And I mean, I can't even imagine how Texas must have responded at the time. You know, so the Zimmerman telegram was huge. That was really the proximate cause. But so much else had happened. What is so interesting to me, one of the things that made me decide actually I should go into do this book, was that when Wilson finally asked Congress for a declaration of war, or to be more accurate, a declaration that a state of war already existed with Germany, he never once mentioned the Lusitania, which goes completely against everything that we're taught.
What was the percentage of Americans on the Lusitania when it sank?
No, you're asking me numbers. I don't know.
It was like 100 and something, right?
128 American. It's not bad. I pulled that out. 128 Americans out of a complement of about 1,200 passengers.
What kind of person would be able to be on a liner like the Lusitania?
Well, all kinds. There were three classes: first, second, and immigrant class, mm-hmm. third class.
It was called immigrant class?
Depending on what you read, yes. And that was pretty common. It was immigrant class. There was a big certain amount of competition actually for the immigrant trade, which is why actually the Lusitania was said to have particularly good third class accommodations, particularly good third class food. Now, we're not talking fancy stuff here. We're not talking foie de veau or anything like that. We're talking about fairly basic fare, but it was very good, and the dining accommodations were good, and so forth. But the kind of person would range from somebody who was going, in this case, since the ship was going from New York to Liverpool, somebody who was a working class person who wanted somehow to get back to England to participate in the war. You know, there was a lot of that. To a member of the Vanderbilt family who was traveling in style in a suite on the top deck of this gorgeous ship, and there were rooms on this thing that even had fireplaces, working wood fireplaces. So a full range of people would be able to and would want to take this voyage.
It had never occurred to me before I read this book, and I suppose it should have, that at the time of the First World War, it would have been very hard to hire merchant seamen, because anybody, European certainly, would be called up to serve their own country.
Yeah. No, trying to find trained, able-bodied seamen for a voyage like this was actually very difficult. It was very difficult for Cunard, very difficult for Captain Turner. And that it did sort of contribute to the ultimate, what ultimately happened with the ship. It was compounded by the fact that under Cunard rules with the Admiralty, which is, of course, that's the governing body that controlled the Royal Navy, under rules with the Admiralty, which initially helped fund the construction of the Lusitania, they had to have only a certain percentage were allowed to be non-British sailors.
We're speaking this hour with author Eric Larson about his book Dead Wake, The Last Crossing of the Lusitania. The book is out now in paperback, and Eric Larson is in town to speak to Arts and Letters Live tonight at First United Methodist Church. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
We'll be right back.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program, where students can customize their degree, like Lonnie Gentry, pursuing healthcare leadership and ethics. More at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with author Eric Larson. His latest book is called Dead Wake, The Last Crossing of the Lusitania. He's in town to speak tonight to Arts and Letters Live. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. I found myself really drawn to Captain Turner, who's a complicated figure and really a guy who was thrown under the bus at the end of all this.
Yeah, I actually came very much to like Captain Turner. First of all, he's the kind of captain where I think it helped for those who got on the ship on that Saturday when it departed New York, to those who actually encountered him, to see him, because he was a veteran captain, very, very able, very highly respected within the Cunard organization, although he had had his scrapes and his mistakes in the past. But he's the kind of guy who, you know, he just, and I'm basing this on what I've read and what I've seen of him in photographs and so forth, but he seems like the kind of guy who was just, you know, conveyed that sense of strength and authority, you know, just and competence. Just like when you're, I don't know about you, but I'm not a great flyer, and I always listen very carefully to the voice of the pilot. Like, is this the kind of person I want flying this plane? You know, there's a certain voice you want, you know, that calm, casual kind of thing. You don't want Woody Allen, you know what I mean?
You want that. You want Sully Sullenberger.
You want Sully Sullenberger, you know, and I think that's kind of what Turner was like. But, you know, Turner, this is going to sound strange, but in a way, he was a victim of his competence. He was so assured and also so convinced that the Lusitania was too fast to be ever caught by a submarine. You know, a submarine could move underwater at a maximum 9 knots. His ship in the Irish Sea was traveling across the Atlantic at 21 knots, and the Irish Sea was moving at 18 for various reasons. But
what's a knot compared to a mile per hour?
Let's put it this way. The Lusitania could do maximum, with all boilers operating, it could do 26 knots, which is about 30 miles an hour.
Okay.
Yeah. Don't ask me why they just don't say miles an hour. Somebody else can explain that. I don't know. You know, it's confounding. You know, he also is still a believer in, you know, the old ways of maritime warfare. And, you know, he'd made it across, and he was within sight of the Irish coast, you know, and I don't think he felt that there was really much danger, although suddenly at one point as he was moving along the Irish coast, he was starting to get warnings about submarines ahead, and then paradoxically it seemed like there were submarines behind. And as I think the best appraisal of what happened with Turner was what the head of the investigation into the sinking finally said, was that, you know, he was a man who essentially did the best he could and was put in a situation for which he had been untrained. There was no training that he had experienced that could have helped him to cope with what he faced that day.
The cargo aboard the ship, and you have an exhaustive list in the book of what was there. Some of it was, you know, there's tons of candy. There were.
I love lists, by the way. I love lists. I do.
It was really fun to read that there were weapons aboard, but they were crated up and that sort of thing.
Well, let's be specific. What was aboard? There were tons of small arms ammunition, mm-hmm. And then there was a shipment also of relatively inert, so-called shrapnel shells. They weren't in a dangerous state, but they were there. And there was no secret to the fact that this was there. After the ship set sail, Cunard released the manifest, and all this stuff was there, along with everything else, the candy, the, you know, the dental tools, and all the other stuff that was shipped on this ship. And you know, incidentally, I mean, there continues to be this sort of conspiracy theory that there were high explosives secreted among the cargo. You know, one writer speculated that, here there were all these barrels of oysters, and it was probably high explosives, this particular author says, because the rule was that you don't have oysters in months unless they have an R, and here it was May. So why were these barrels of oysters on this ship? And, and nobody really knows if there were additional, shipments of high explosives aboard the Lusitania.
Let me interrupt. This is a thing because there was a secondary explosion after the single torpedo.
Secondary
hit.
Explosion, and also because the ship sank so quickly. It sank mm-hmm. in 18 minutes. Mm-hmm. But one thing that I can assure you is that whether or not there were additional explosives aboard had nothing to do with the sinking. This is just something that has been perpetuated really ever since the 1960s in a fairly sensational account of the sinking, and which even contended that there were naval guns aboard. There were not,
But the open portholes may have made a difference. Oh,
the open portholes were one of the interesting elements. See, the thing that fascinated me about the story was that so many forces came together in that one moment in the Irish Sea to cause this disaster. Is the classic cascade of things. No one thing could account for it, but once everything started going to hell, that ship was absolutely doomed. And 18 minutes, it's probably lucky it lasted that long, to be honest. Portholes, one of the rules was, and Turner had actually ordered that all the portholes be closed, because, a porthole is essentially a hole in the ship,
And a vulnerability.
And a huge vulnerability. And I can't remember the number, but there was a statistic as to exactly how much water can flow through an open porthole if that porthole is submerged, and it's an astonishing amount of water. And it turned out that because it was such a mild day, this part of the story also, such a mild day, preternaturally mild day in May off the Irish coast, the sea was smooth as glass, sunny, fog had just suddenly lifted, yielding this absolutely brilliantly sunny, warm, windless day. And, it's just like it was so warm that people actually opened their portholes. They weren't supposed to, but they opened their portholes because they were stifling, So by the time the ship started going under, there were at least 70 portholes that were open, 70. And it's something like 3.75 tons of water per minute, I think, per porthole or something like that. So you put that together. But also, we can talk about what ultimately happened in a bit, I guess, but...
Yeah. We'll fast forward up there anyway. Everybody remembered Titanic, so there were adequate numbers of lifeboats.
Right.
There were life jackets. Nobody thought to teach anybody how to put on the life jackets.
Oh well, there's a number of things that you take the lessons from the Titanic, and they only took them so far.
Mm-hmm.
Titanic did not have enough lifeboats. Lusitania had more than enough lifeboat capacity for its people,
and
more than enough life jackets and stuff. But one thing that is kind of an irony is that the third class got the old life jackets, which everybody knew how to use, and so did the crew. They got the old life jackets, and those were fairly conventional, very straightforward. But there was a new kind of life jacket aboard the Lusitania that was complicated to put on, but once on was very, very effective. These life jackets, first of all, were stored in the cabins, not up on the decks, which is something that's very different now. There was an instruction sheet on the cabinet, right? Well, nobody was really thinking ahead to the idea that, okay, what if your cabin is dark and you're scared to death anyway because you got to come down into your cabin to get this thing and then run back up? You're not going to spend, the next 10 minutes with a candle reading the instructions about how to put this thing on. So it turned out that a lot of people put it on wrong, and if you put it on wrong, it was catastrophic because it inverted the flotation effect. That is to say, it sort of kept your butt out of the water, but your head was under, and that killed an awful lot of people. And then the lifeboats, yes, it had plenty of lifeboats, but, once this thing got hit by the torpedo, once it began to fill with water, again, this had to do with the design, how the torpedo struck, the fact that it knocked out the engine so the ship couldn't stop. And you got to stop to launch a lifeboat, so it couldn't stop. So it experienced something that's referred to as forced flooding. Not only was there this gaping hole in these 70 portholes, but this gaping hole, so the water was just flooding into the ship, into these empty so-called longitudinal coal bunkers along the side of the ship, that it took on a 25-degree list to starboard. So you think about that, 25-degree list to starboard. Suddenly, the boats on the starboard side, the so-called Class A boats, which are the traditional lifeboats we all think about, suddenly they're all, you know, anywhere from 8 to 10 feet out from the hull, right? And you're 60 feet above the water. That's scary, right? Yeah. It's hard to get into those boats. And suddenly the boats on the port side, they're heavy. These boats are very heavy. And so they all want to lean against the boat, right? And they're really essentially unusable, although people tried to use them with catastrophic result. In the end, even though, again, it had many, many more lifeboats and lifeboat capacity than necessary, only six lifeboats got away. Only six lifeboats got away because of this weird confluence of bizarre things.
Maybe it pales in comparison when you consider, it does, when you consider, you know, the loss of human life and the suffering and the terror. But there was priceless material. There was the original annotated manuscript of Charles Dickens for A Christmas Carol.
Well, it wasn't the original manuscript. It was Charles Dickens' personal copy of A Christmas Carol that he had annotated for a lawsuit. He was suing people who were trying to rip off without permission parts of his book. And there was a bookseller aboard, quite famous bookseller at the time. This is one of the things I like about writing about the past is, you know, I mean, my God, here was this bookseller, Charles Laureate, who was famous the world over.
Like a star. Yeah.
I mean, yeah, a rock star. I mean, really? Seriously? You know, this is like the Mick Jagger booksellers, you know. Here he is, you know, traveling first class, going to London. He's got a copy of this book, which he had borrowed from one of his clients in order to bring it to a scholar who wanted to look at the notes in the book itself. And he also brought a variety of other collection of other drawings by Thackeray, who illustrated his own books. So he had all these original things with him. Ship sinks. Those are lost forever, and it's just really kind of tragic.
Can you imagine saying to somebody, I will deliver it personally?
I know,
and
I know.
Realizing
but
what's
see,
happening.
This is another index of how confident everybody was. Charles Laureate, you know, never in a million years would he have had, you know, if he were concerned about, you know, making it to Britain, he wouldn't have brought these priceless things aboard. But he was like, no, and because they're in his personal possession, they're even safer. They're in his Rome, you know, so... There were, by the way, there was a rumor to be actually the manifest says that there was a collection of paintings brought by a very famous art collector, and the collection was rumored to include some very, very expensive things like Titians and so forth, but nobody will ever know.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to John in Dallas on the phone. Hi, John.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
Appreciate it. Great conversation. I wondered, there's a notice in 1935, I think, by the German Imperial Embassy stating that people should be very careful about going on a Lusitania because it would be crossing into, you know, war territory and that they were liable to destruction. And do you know anything about those?
Yeah. Actually, we kind of alluded to that earlier. And you know, it was 1915. The interesting thing was that this warning, this notice, I just marvel at this, but by sheer coincidence, appeared in New York newspapers on the morning of the Lusitania's departure. The embassy had actually composed this notice well before, at least 2 weeks before, no, a week before. And what this notice said was essentially, in no uncertain terms, it said that anybody who is sailing into the so-called war zone off Britain, it does so at their own risk, and that includes people who are not necessarily British citizens, because, you know, mistakes can happen. You know, they were just saying, you know, that avoid this area. So yeah, that's what was in the paper that morning.
Wartime or not, it's really hard not to fault the German U-boat commander Schwieger, who launched this knowing it was a civilian craft, or assuming that it was. However, I have to say I had no idea the risk that a U-boat would take in launching a torpedo in 1915. There was as good a chance as not that it would swing back around and hit the ship.
One of the things that I was sort of fascinated by / appalled by was the failure rate of German torpedoes during World War I. You know, these are fearsome weapons when they work, but 60% failed. 60% failure. And Schwieger, on his own patrol, he experienced, I can't remember how many failures. And in fact, he attacked a ship just after the Lusitania, and the torpedo failed. And
one just sat there.
One of them never left. I'm trying to remember the sequence. One never left the tube. One was launched but never struck. And he was flummoxed as to exactly why. That was another part of the story, by the way, is that, you know, I was kind of hoping that the submarine commander would be this really evil Max von Sydow character with the scar down the side of his face, the whole deal. But one thing I love about writing history is that, and I always try to respect nuance and, you know, warts and non-warts, you know, and this guy turned out to be a nice guy. Young guy, handsome guy, funny guy. His crew loved him. You know,
kept a puppy on board.
Six puppies at one point. You know, he was really a humane guy, and here he is. And he had a horrible, horrible patrol. I mean, he left Germany. One thing another reason that I decided I could go ahead with this book was that he left behind the war log for his voyage, and it's not just a spare collection of position reports and so forth. It's a narrative, nice chunks of narrative where he talks about, you know, from departure on up the North Sea, over the top of Scotland and so forth, his encounters with, you know, an almost fatal encounter with a screen of German destroyers and you know, awful weather, fog, coming down the other side of the British Isles on his way to the Irish Sea. It was just endless fog. And it was so awful that by the time he entered the Irish Sea, he'd sunk a few small ships, nothing, not even ships, you know, like 9-ton vessel and another vessel. And you know, he was really getting kind of down, and there was a problem with his fuel consumption. And he actually made the decision once he got into the Irish Sea. He said, "We're going to go home. We're turning around." He was on his way home when he happened to see this large ship coming over the distant horizon. And even then, when he saw that ship, he realized there was no hope of catching it. You know, he was traveling at 9 knots underwater, and here's this vessel that at that point was going 18 knots. But then something kind of miraculous happened.
We'll talk about that in just a minute. My guest is author Eric Larson. His newest book is Dead Wake, The Last Crossing of the Lusitania. The book is out now in paperback, and Eric Larson will speak tonight to Arts and Letters Live at First United Methodist Church in Dallas. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can customize your master's degree to distinguish yourself in the workplace. You can apply now for summer. Deadline is May 1st. More at smu.edu/MLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with author Eric Larson about his book Dead Wake, The Last Crossing of the Lusitania. He's in town to speak tonight to Arts and Letters Live at First United Methodist Church in Dallas. You can join us at 800-933-5372 or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. So Captain Schwieger thought there was no way he's going to catch up to this ship in the distance.
Right.
And then something
happened. He thought there was no way he was going to catch up to the ship. And by the way, I should note that until just shortly before when he spots this ship, the fog had been just absolutely dense in the Irish Sea. You know, and fog is impossible for a submarine to operate, and also very dangerous because a ship passing through the fog could run over that submarine. And submarines were really fragile. You know, an impact from the ship would send it to the bottom with all the crew aboard. You know, it's just they were very, very fragile. So the fog clears. He's looking through his periscope. He sees this ship coming over the horizon. There will always be a lingering question: what did he think he saw? But it's kind of a false question because, my God, the Lusitania was like everybody knew it was what it looked like: four giant funnels, German transmitters had, you know, at midnight had been reporting the comings and goings of Cunard ships, including the Lusitania. You know, what else could he possibly have thought this thing was? So anyway, so he sees this thing. The ship is moving at this point at 18 knots for various reasons, and the submarine is moving at 9 knots submerged. Schwieger decides, well, you know, he's going to follow. See what happens. You know, I guess it was an act of just sheer optimism or hope because it had been such a bust so far with his, you know, patrol. So he follows the Lusitania, and then to his absolute surprise, the Lusitania makes a turn that puts it right in his wheelhouse for a torpedo attack, and he goes for it. Takes him a while to set up that shot, but there it was. However, you know, adding to the quirkiness of the whole thing, all the chance things that happen is that, you know, Schwieger, when you calculate a torpedo shot, you have to gauge the speed of the ship you're going to hit, because, you know, it's like if you think about duck hunting, if a bird is in flight, you got to essentially aim ahead, you know. So, and he miscalculated. He entered the wrong speed into his calculation, and that's why the torpedo hit where it did, and that's why it was such a catastrophic strike. So.
There were first-person accounts from people who did survive.
Yes.
There were documents extant, letters that people had been writing that I guess came to the surface.
Literally.
Yeah. And you found some really just interesting ways to recreate what it was like aboard the ship before disaster struck.
Well, that was one of my goals, was to really, what motivated the book as well, was this idea, well, what would that have been like to have been aboard? So I really wanted to find a way to capture it in detail. And anybody who's in the book is in there for the simple reason that he or she left a ton of detail in a letter or some other document. So in the case of Charles Laureate, first of all, very interesting character, bookseller in Boston, you know, the whole deal. But after the war, because he had lost this Dickens book and also the Thackeray drawings, he filed a petition with the Mixed Claims Commission after the war, which was set up to make Germany pay for losses of ordinary Americans. And so he filed, usually they were like, you know, maybe 2-page claims. His claim was 180 pages long. Hmm. And the beauty of his claim was that he documented everything, including his departure from Boston, what he did, when he picked up these things, what suitcase he put them in, what suitcases he brought with him, you know, all the kind of stuff that is absolutely gold if you're going to do this kind of history. You really have to tell, when you want to tell it as a story, you need the stuff. You can't make it up. You have to have it. And God bless him, he gave it to me, you know. All this stuff was terrific. So he made a really, really terrific character. I mean, there were probably other characters who are more, maybe more vivid, more compelling, that could have gone in the book, but they didn't leave the detail behind.
There was one guy who, if he lived today, would be writing in all caps all the time on Twitter. Tell us about him.
Dwight Harris. He's my favorite character in the book. Mm-hmm. Actually, he was a young New Yorker on his way to Britain to get engaged, and he was just a young, enthusiastic guy. But also prudent. The day before departure on Lusitania, he bought his own personal life vest at the John Wanamaker department store in Manhattan. But he, after having survived the sinking, he wrote this long letter to his mother. This letter resides in the New York Historical Society, and it is so charming because, first of all, it gives lots of detail, but also he was so enthusiastic. He was so delighted to have survived, so delighted to have been a part of this tremendous event. Like every other sentence has like 4 exclamation points, you know, and it's just charming. It's just charming. And I'm so glad he survived.
Theodate Pope was, is that how you say her name?
Theodate? Yep. Yeah.
You
could just call her Theo.
Theo.
That's what people did.
She sounds like someone that I could be having coffee with next week.
Well, yeah. I mean, Theodate Pope was terrific. She was one of America's first licensed female architects. She was also in keeping with the time, very common for the era. She was a spiritualist, believed in the objective investigation of the afterlife to try to determine whether there was anything to it or not. But she was also, I think, the thing that really drew me to Theda Pope. I love character. Well, what really drew me was that she too left a lot of material behind, a lot of detail. But what also drew me was one thing I look for in characters is a connection to the past that makes us feel like people weren't so different. They had some of the concerns that we all have. And she had dealt with lifelong depression. And we all know about depression. We know people who were depressed. We've experienced depression, you know. And it was just really interesting for me to explore some of that in her background. She was boarding this ship for a variety of reasons, one of which was because she felt the travel was going to be, you know, might help with her depression.
She guessed wrong, unfortunately.
Well, she guessed wrong, yeah.
But she did survive.
She did survive after a very traumatic experience.
Yeah. You know. All right, let's go back to the phones now. We have Brant on the line in Richardson. Hi, Brant.
Hello, ma'am. Very interesting conversation today. If I might, I wanted to ask your guest about the German motivations behind not specifically the Lusitania sinking, but the U-boat campaign.
Yeah. Well, you know, the from the German perspective, what they were trying to do was, you know, it was a wholly prudent battle objective. They were trying to block all supplies of munitions, food, whatever, from reaching Britain. And that's why they declared this war zone around the British Isles, and that's why they warned everybody, look, you know, we're deadly serious about this. We're gonna sink whatever we can, and if it happens not to be a British flag carrier, well, we're sorry, but, you know, it's going to happen, you know. And so that was their strategy, you know, it's the kind of strategy that unfortunately includes a lot of mission creep. And really, by the end of the war, they were sinking hospital ships and civilian liners and everything.
I'm always interested to hear about Winston Churchill before he was the Churchill that we think of in the Second World War. He was a little younger here, and really in a kind of a pitched battle with other people who had been in charge for much longer.
Yeah, Winston Churchill remains one of my absolute favorite characters of history because he was irrepressible. He was at different times in his career more competent than at others, but he was always highly energetic, highly detail-oriented, always had his hand in the pie in a way that, you know, a lot of his peers found sort of objectionable, frankly. But so here was Winston Churchill, who... The start of the war is the First Lord of the Admiralty, meaning he is the boss of the Admiralty and therefore the boss of the Royal Navy. And actually, he took a lot of interest in the day-to-day operational elements of the Navy as well. And so he was a very interesting character at this time, because, you know, A, he knew about this entity within the Admiralty. He helped found it. He was in on the founding of this entity called Room 40. Which was a super secret entity, and actually remained secret until after the war, and was eventually disclosed. But throughout most of the war, it was reading, deciphering, decoding virtually every German naval wireless communique that was made, at least up until around 1918. And this was incredibly valuable. But now, one problem was, from Churchill's perspective, you know, he really, the importance was not to give away the fact that this stuff was being read. And so how do you give it away? Well, you react to wireless messages in a certain way, and that might signal to the Germans that, oh, they knew about this ahead of time. And this becomes a controversial point because the first 24 hours of U-20's voyage, that's the submarine that sank Lusitania, all the wireless communications back and forth were intercepted by Room 40 and read and decoded. They're sitting there in the archives of the United Kingdom. You know, anybody can go look at them. So much detail was known about this submarine, its positions. And by the way, you know, anybody who reads the book, if you want to type those positions into Google Maps, you'll find exactly where the submarine was at that point visually. So everything was known about, and including this one detailed wireless message that were essentially the orders as to where the submarine was going to go. Excuse me. So the Admiralty knew exactly where the submarine was headed, and then it was headed to a patrol zone off the Mersey River, off Liverpool, right in the mouth of the – right in the channel that all the Cunard ships, including Lusitania, would use to get into Liverpool Harbor. They knew this, absolutely knew this without doubt. knew the submarine was on its way, knew that it had gotten as far as, you know, off the Scottish coast. It was going over the top of the British Isles because it was safer than going through the channel at this point. But never conveyed anything to the captain or to Cunard or to anybody. And the question is, well, was that Churchill's doing? You know, because Churchill, one thing about Churchill that was absolutely certain is that he would have loved an event to occur that would draw America into the war. So,
and the Admiralty ultimately tried really hard to blame Captain Turner. There was, strangely, like this guy in Ireland, kind of a local official, looked at this and seems, according to your assessment, to have guessed right about Turner's, you know, fault in this or lack thereof.
Well, the first thing, you know, was, you know, I guess there's always competition for glory, but the first thing was the coroner in Ireland held an inquest, you know, which is justified because bodies were being, you know, were washing up actually in Ireland, so it was his territory, you know, and he absolved Turner. He said this was, you know, he was a brave man caught at a time when, you know, there just was nothing that he could do about it. But even before the inquest was done, there was a message that came from the admiral saying, look, don't say anything about this. Don't say anything about Turner's role, you know, because they didn't say why he shouldn't, but they just wanted to gag the whole thing. And he wasn't going to go for that. But fast forward, the Admiralty tried to blame Turner for the whole thing. Now, you think about this for a second. The propaganda value of simply letting it stand that it was the submarine commander and Germany that sank this ship was huge, huge. Why on earth did they try to shift the blame to Captain Turner? What was the rationale? And, you know, there's no smoking document in this case, but the best argument is that this was Churchill, this was the Admiralty trying to preserve the secret of Room 40, trying to preserve the secret by throwing Turner to the wolves. You know, one of the interesting things is that there was a one of the wireless messages intercepted was on the way back when Schwieger matter-of-factly notified his superiors that he had in fact sunk the Lusitania, and he had done it with one torpedo. This is a message before anybody knew, before there had been a world, you know, outcry. You know, there's no reason for this to be at all faked or anything. He says he did it with one torpedo. And the Admiralty, during this whole investigation, took testimony from people saying, oh, that there were two torpedoes, and ultimately ruled that there were two torpedoes that hit the Lusitania, even though knowing full well that there was only one torpedo. Churchill himself maintained that illusion for decades after the war, even in his great history of World War I. He says it was two torpedoes, which is fascinating.
Is the shipwreck still down there?
Shipwreck's still down there. No effort was made to raise it.
It would be curious to see artifacts and things brought back.
Artifacts have been brought up. Propellers. I mean, sometimes I think there are too many propellers in too many places to possibly be Lusitania propellers, but they're you know, those have been brought up, and some artifacts.
Eric Larson's new book is called Dead Wake, The Last Crossing of the Lusitania. You can hear him speak tonight to Arts and Letters Live at First United Methodist Church in Dallas. Eric, it's always a pleasure. Thanks for making this time for us.
Thank you very much.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and the show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.